This episode is brought to you in part by Adobe. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for designing, sharing, and prototyping experiences. Try the free beta today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more. This episode is also brought to you in part by Real-Time Board. Real-Time Board empowers distributed and co-located agile product teams to create the next big things. Visit realtimeboard.com/UD for your free trial and 25% off your paid subscription. Over a million UXers can't be wrong. Real-Time Board, Whiteboard. Finally in your browser.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. So good to be back with you again after the season break. I have a couple of really neat things stirring up with the show that I'd like to announce. One, I was invited to record a live episode at An Event Apart, my favorite design conference, by the way. They are hosting their very first episode in Denver after over a decade. So really, truly honored to be a part of that. So excited. It's December is when it's happening. And they have also given me a coupon code that will give you $100 off your registration, not just for the Denver event, but for any event, by the way, happening throughout the remainder of this year. So if you're excited to go to An Event Apart, and why wouldn't you be, and you can find the means to do so through your company, etc., please feel free to use the coupon code AEAUD at checkout to save $100 off this awesome conference. Also, I am super honored to announce that Adobe has joined as a sponsor and a partner on User Defenders for a couple of seasons, so I couldn't be more excited about that as well. And as a believer in Adobe's products and a user for ever since I started doing this stuff in 96, I'm truly, truly honored and excited to welcome them aboard and highly recommend listening and tuning in and taking action on the messages that I'll be sharing in the coming episodes. I just want to take a second to share an iTunes review that UD received recently. I'm trying to get into the habit of this because I sincerely appreciate when you take the time to let me know how you feel about the show. And obviously, hopefully it's positive. I got my first 1-star review recently. It wasn't a review. It was just somebody just clicked the 1-star. So it made me sad for a minute, but I'm thankful. Most of you love what I'm doing here, and it just means so much to me when I get to hear it and see it on the iTunes reviews. So this is one left on March 28th by Lenny Stokes. And Lenny Stokes says, "Awesome host, awesome guest, 5 stars. I've been listening to this podcast for several months, but I use Google Play, not iTunes. Google Play doesn't have an option to leave reviews, so I'm using my iPad here to show some love. Jason, you are one sincere and personable host, and this podcast is keeping me sane and entertained during my commute to the old office. Thanks for what you do, and please keep it coming." Lenny, if that's your name, I think it is. Thanks so much, man. That means a ton to me. I appreciate you actually using your iPad, going to a different platform in order to let me know how you feel about the show. So super appreciated. Thanks a lot. And Defenders listening, I would certainly appreciate if you would take the time to leave a rating and review. It helps the show a ton also to get in front of new designers that haven't heard of the show and help them stay inspired as well on their design journey. You can do so by going to userdefenders.com/review. Thanks again in advance. Welcome to episode 35. Today's interview is with onboarding superhero Samuel Hulick. Samuel dove so deep into what makes great product design, I'm still climbing out of the well. This was my first interview I've conducted at night, as Samuel has a severe case of chronic sleep phase disorder, which means his day is our night and our night is his day. So I really appreciate his willingness to do this with me after hours. And I made sure that I had because I know you're concerned, I had an extra cup of my own fresh roasted coffee this afternoon, which was absolutely my pleasure. Enjoy my interview. I hope it's your pleasure with Samuel Hulick. Samuel Hulick is the man behind useronboard.com, where he creates popular teardowns of onboarding user flows on some of the most popular digital products around. He's also an author of a book he's definitely the authority on called The Elements of User Onboarding. He's a consultant, UX designer, and front-end developer based out of beautiful Portland, Oregon. He's also a prolific writer, publishing some pretty viral posts on Medium these days. You might be surprised to learn that Samuel is a high school dropout. Samuel, you're not alone. I am too, my friend. Welcome to User Defender, Samuel. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Thank It's great to be here among good company, it sounds like.
Oh, thank you, my friend. So every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I like to start the show by you taking a few moments just to give us a look into your personal life.
Sure. Is there a specific place you'd want me to start, or just kind of like where I kicked my career off, or?
Anywhere you want, my friend. Really, the way I like to answer, like to ask this question is kind of like, what do you like to do when you're not working?
Well, I mean, that's one of the great joys in my life is that I really do genuinely love what I do for a living. So, when yes. I'm not being paid to do it, I kind of just keep doing it anyway.
Nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, from an origin standpoint, I was really interested in the internet and the World Wide Web when, you know, it kind of started becoming more mainstream in like the mid 90s. And it was something that I found really compelling that you can like go in and create the media and edit it yourself and things like that. And so in a very amateur and non-professional capacity, I was always kind of just like the person who knew how to make websites for a very long time, and then eventually decided to hang out my shingle and jump into it as a professional. That was probably about 10 to 15 years ago, depending on how. I feel like I've been saying 10 years ago for like 3 or 4 years, so
15
I guess
is
it's
fair.
Probably closer to 15 at this point. But yeah, from there it was just something where I could tell right away that you know, websites are something that are supposed to be used and are supposed to be positively impacting people's lives and positively influencing their behavior. And I started as a developer and found that a lot of times I was being asked to code up things that I was like, just as an advocate of the people who will be using this, I don't really think this is what you want to do. And a lot of the projects I was working on were kind of from like a waterfall design methodology where you make all the decisions up front and then kind of build it out at the end. And so a lot of times I would hear, you know, something like, well, we're already out of time and budget, so just make these Photoshop documents clickable and call it a day. And so I just kind of grit my teeth and do that, but felt like I could bring a lot more to the table. And it was at that point that I decided to research and educate myself as much as possible and you know, get my skills into a place where I could legitimately call myself a user experience designer. And that was about, well, again, I've been saying 5 years for 3 or 4 years, so that was probably more like 7 or 8 years ago. And then from there, just really realized the importance of user onboarding specifically and decided to focus primarily on that about 4 years ago.
Nice. So when you started, Full House was still on, right?
when I started getting online, I suppose so. That's a little cringy to think about, but I guess that's true.
Yeah, it's nice. And that's a little hat tip to your is your software wearing too much makeup article, which I thought was great, by the way.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was fun. That was an interesting one.
So, you know, what's neat, Samuel, I was listening to you tell your origin story and you're talking about how you started out as a developer and I could just hear your empathy for the users come through. And when you were telling that story and I was just also learning recently, I haven't totally gotten through the whole thing yet, but John Maeda's, very popular design and tech report he does every year. The theme seems to be this year is a lot about designers who code, and he's been holding to that for a while, and he's still, I think even more now, is really evangelizing that message and also saying, you know, developers who have empathy for the user, like that's the future really of our field. And so I think that's what makes you a really great fit for what you do, because you do, I mean, you understand that side of things because that's where you started, but you really have an empathy for the users, and especially in the onboarding arena, which is where you've really become an authority and an expert, even writing a book about it. So I just wanted to tell you that. I noticed that, and I think that that's what makes you such a great fit. And speaking of onboarding, I think it'd be a good opportunity just to kind of deviate a little bit and talk about it. And what is user onboarding, and why is it important?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, as far as like, you know, just touching very quickly on what you were saying about being a developer and having empathy, you know, for me, it wasn't motivated by like a mushy bleeding heart sort of like, but what about the users kind of a thing? It was really just like, if we're all working really hard on this and we want it to succeed, we have to create something that's in alignment with what the people who are using it want to do. And the more we could be helpful to them, the more we will succeed. It's a mutual success sort of thing, but it mm-hmm. depends on the optional use of it. You know, someone has to elect to bring the software into their life and operate it in order for us to be able to succeed. So aligning ourselves around the users succeeding is really, you know, the kind of the name of the game, as far as I'm concerned.
I love it.
What that has to do with onboarding is that a lot of times I think that the incentive structures that are currently in place in the software world, as far as the software creation world, and then also just kind of the division of labor within software organizations, large and small, you tend to have a product team or product department that's just totally focused on the product itself, and they're designing new features and squashing bugs. And ideally, you know, performing usability tests and improving the user experience of the product, but kind of, you know, really just focused on the product itself and you know, creating as many power users as they can. And then alternatively, there's sort of this divide between the product team versus the marketing team, which is really about getting the company's name out there, you know, building up PR, acquiring signups, and you know, ultimately, if you can get people through your landing pages and pitch pages and homepage and get them to sign up for the product, a lot of times the marketing department or the marketing team will kind of, you know, be finished with their work once the person signs up for the product. And so what I really look at onboarding as taking marketing signups and turning them into product teams, power users, and who's really responsible from an organizational standpoint of confirming that the efforts of both teams or both departments are working together, and ultimately that the users who, if someone isn't overseeing that, that people aren't falling through the cracks from a usage standpoint. So that's one way of looking at it, but that's kind of my working definition of user onboarding is essentially increasing the likelihood that people are successful when they are trying to adopt your product.
Yes. And what got you so passionate about this? Because, I mean, this is what you do now, and you make a living doing this stuff. And I just want to know, like, what got you so passionate about the whole onboarding experience?
Well, a number of things. One is that I also worked in a customer success role for a while, and it was something where in that role that I had, I didn't have a lot of product oversight, or I couldn't make a lot of user experience changes. And so I would see people sign up and make it a third of the way to, you know, even getting some vague hint of value out of the product, and then just abandon it. And you start looking at the numbers, and, you know, it's not at all surprising to see something like for every sign up that you get, half of them never even log back in a second time. And again, like, just looking at that return of investment, where your product team is working so hard to build this compelling product and your marketing team is working so hard to get the name out there, and then, you know, just whiffing on half of the people automatically. And then even taking a step further back from that and thinking about how unlikely it is that someone would ever sign up for your product to begin with, where, you know, someone has to hear about it probably a number of times, and then also find themselves in a situation where they're like, you know what? Let's say it's Basecamp, you know, like project management software. You know what? I've just like had enough with these projects that haven't been managed very well. It's time to do something about it. I'm going to fight the inertia of like the rest of my life right now, put things on pause and like learn a totally different way of doing things. It's just so unlikely that that happens. And then when someone signs up for a product, it means it has happened, that they've totally defied the odds. And then, you know, you have this investment and attention from them that you probably aren't really going to get again, even if things do go well. And so just really making good on that moment is something that I find really rewarding from a personal standpoint, and then also from a business standpoint. It's one very, very high leverage lever that you can pull.
I love that perspective, Samuel. Just speaking about how hard the product team is working to build this sexy product that people need and that people want, but then then kind of phoning it in on actually getting them on board to use this thing. I think that's such a great perspective, and that totally makes sense of why you're so passionate about this. So that's awesome.
Just to, you know, one other take on that, like, yeah, that's kind of, you know, where I come from as a designer or as a product person, mm-hmm. but there's also an element of it, you know, just because I'm a person who uses digital products or software. And, mm-hmm. It's something for me just on a personal level, where I think of software as kind of being like a way to take on a superpower of some sort. Like, if I use Google Maps, I have like this kind of prescience about where in my city traffic jams are taking place right now. Yes. Or, you know, I'm using Skype and I'm having a conversation with someone who's like, you know, very far away from me. And so like, I have this superpower of being able to like transmit my thoughts or whatever that might be. Yes. And not to get too meta, but like even people listening to the podcast, like that's you're operating software to achieve a result that you otherwise wouldn't be able to in your corporeal form. And to me, it's a real shame that when people are open to taking on that new superpower and are ready to and are asking that of the software, for it to be kind of, as you said, sort of phoned in or overlooked in that way. So just as a person in the world, I'd like to see it be better for that reason, if nothing else.
Oh, I love that. And I love how you use the superpower term. You're speaking my language, and we're definitely going right. to get into what your design superpower is in a moment here. But I wanted to ask you first, who's been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
I would say that the person who not only really opened my mind to a lot of this, but also took a lot of the kind of scattered ideas or perspectives that I had and kind of consolidated it into a framework is Kathy Sierra. And she doesn't have a whole lot of an internet profile presence, but if you look her up, there was a talk that she gave at the Business of Software conference in 2009 that it is like, if I were to just point at one thing that really sums up my philosophy on software, it would definitely be that.
Wow, that sounds definitely worthy of a link in the show notes. So I appreciate you mentioning Kathy. So that's awesome. We'll have to, I'm sure the defenders listening are going to want to see that talk now. So awesome. Well, let's talk about life-altering experiences and get into your transformation. Now, every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have, as we were talking about superpowers, and they harness them for the greater good. But we know significant transformation can occur through failure, as it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Can you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Yeah, you know, I was trying to think of a good answer to this one. It's something where I would say an indication of the kind of failure that I think I could point to is that, like, I haven't had any major things blow up where it's just like, oh, you know, I really, you know, placed a really big bet on X and it totally turned out to be Y or something along those lines. And so, like, looking at my career, I would say that if I were to really fault myself, it would be for not necessarily having taken as many chances as I could have, and not necessarily being able, especially to have worked on projects where I could look at them in retrospect and demonstrate in an empirical kind of way. We thought that this would influence people's behavior in such a fashion, and we measured the outcome of that, and this was the result. And so I really like to operate from an empirical and experiment driven sort of design method, I suppose you could say. Something kind of along the lines of like lean startup, if that's something your listeners are familiar with.
Oh yeah.
But you know, for me, it's something where coming from, it's kind of like I mentioned before, with the being from the world of development, you have like unit tests where you know can say we improved the response time of this query by 3/10 of a second or something like that. Or, you know, from a front end development standpoint, you can write a lot of like CSS and then you pull up the page and refresh it and see if what you guessed would work actually results in the outcome on the screen that you thought they would. And for me, a big passion of my career from a design perspective has been to approach it in a similar way, not in like in a deterministic, like, you know, treating people like an ant farm kind of a thing, but just basically saying like, if we do truly believe that design is a power that can be used for good. How is that power being wielded? Are we being studious and scientific about this, where we're approaching it in the same way that like an architect would approach the building of a bridge? Or are we just kind of throwing things together and then maybe not even sticking around to find out if it worked or not, and then just moving on to the next thing? And so from a failure standpoint, I wish that there were that I had operated in more of a way, especially early in my career, where I could demonstrably point to things and say, we thought it was going to work out this way, but then it didn't. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the software design world, as I have found it, has been based off of more things like anecdotal evidence, tribal wisdom, things like that.
Wow. Yeah. So what do you want our listeners to take away from that story, Samuel? And just kind of that background of wanting to maybe take more risks, perhaps.
I think it's definitely an element of taking more risks, and then also just kind of putting ourselves as designers on the line, and standing by the predictions that we're making, and being exposing ourselves to the possibility of proving ourselves wrong, essentially. If nothing else really set me on my course, like you were talking about, like it wasn't the origin, but you were saying like the life altering.
Yes. Life altering experience. Yes.
Yeah. And I remember I was working at a digital agency at the time of the thing that I'm about to say. And there we were working on like brand experiences for like athletic companies. And, you know, they would want like an interactive touchscreen to get put on a wall or something like that. And the projects, the definition of success was just like, can it be shipped on time? And whether it actually was like a net benefit to the people using it or not was not only something people didn't really care about, it was just like something that would have been impossible to measure, and especially to like iterate on or improve. And that's fine. But I remember one day, this like very tiny thought popped in my head, and it's something that I found that I couldn't shake and still haven't been able to shake. And the question is, how do I know I'm getting better as a designer, rather than how do I know I'm getting better at selling thoughtless crap to people, so to speak, because, you know, anybody can get better at just, you know, bedside manner, or, you know, you look at like the history of medical practice, and like there were some very effective bloodletting salespeople back in the day, but it didn't mean that they were getting better at practicing medicine. And so in that same way, you know, the one thing that that I can trace a lot of my design career back to and a lot of my philosophy back to is like, can I even just demonstrate to myself that I'm improving as a designer? And then, you know, once you start thinking along those lines, you kind of have to start looking at benchmarks that go beyond just being able to convince your peers that you're good.
Mm. Yeah. Trepanation, anyone? Yeah, you got a headache? Let's put a hole in your head. That happened. That happened in tribal cultures. They believed there was some demon or something in the head. But yeah, thank God for modern medicine. But yes, I like what you said about kind of the deadlines becoming more important than actually a successful product. That's not good. And I think that it's really, especially when you think about how much money is being spent to build the thing, when the deadline becomes more important than is this product right? And is it going to work well for the audience and things like that? That's a big deal, you know? And I used to work at a print shop, and one thing I remember one of my coworkers would always say, because we face that, especially in print, you're always under these really unrealistic deadlines. Not unlike our field too, but, he would always say, do you want it right or right now? Right? Uh-huh. So I always remember that. It's like, yeah, you want it right or right now. You got to pick one.
Yeah. There's this sort of like, you know, I don't even know what you would call it. A saying in the software world, I guess, which is that great product managers ship, or like this is a mentality that like it's all about shipping. And for me, it's totally the opposite, where you can crank out features till the cows come home. But if those aren't features that are useful or helpful or even relevant to the people that you're creating them for, then ultimately you're really just wasting your time and the time of the people who you're exposing those to, but especially your time. Yeah. And so, you know, for me, another reason that I find user onboarding to be so compelling is if you really want to up retention or engagement within your product, your next killer feature to really win people over probably shouldn't be a feature at all. It should probably be some sort of improvement to the first 5 minutes of using your product. It should be building in more retention hooks, investing in something like lifecycle emails or notifications or all kinds of different ways to drive engagement and therefore retention within your product that isn't like, okay, as soon as we ship, you know, this algorithm, then everything's going to be great. Or like, customers have asked for blank, so let's just make that and it's going to, you know, make our company succeed. For me, I think, you know, if you can get software that people are finding relevant and are using, you can really, there's a lot of room to optimize what you have in place rather than just tacking one more, you know, item of feature-itis clutter on top of what you already have there.
Yes. And you say, and I love this, you say people don't buy products, they buy better versions of themselves. And what do you mean by that, Samuel?
Sure, yeah. What I mean by that is again, looking at how unlikely it is that someone signs up for your product at all, and then being open to trying something new, that you can think of signing up for a product, even if you, you know, just yourself doing it personally, not even thinking about, you know, talking about designers versus users or whatever, but just we as people in the world, when we sign up for something, it's kind of an expression of hope that we are in a situation that we're finding, that we have a motivation to get out of. So I don't like the way I'm currently managing projects. I'm going to look for alternative ways. And then you come across Basecamp and then you're like, I'm open to the Basecamp way of doing things. I'm going to sign up with them and see how that works. And then ultimately, you know, there's this sense of hope that you're going to be better off in the future by having incorporated this product into your life, and that you're going to be kind of a better you in that specific capacity. Mm-hmm. And again, kind of like tying that back to like the notion of software as a superpower. And so when I, you know, decide to subscribe to Netflix, or when I, you know, pay my Skype bill, or when I use Intercom, or all these different products that are in our life, I'm hoping that I can take on a superpower and be a better version of myself. I'm not invested in it because I want to be really good at operating the Netflix interface. I want to be better at relaxing at the end of a hard day, and I think Netflix, I can kind of quote unquote hire Netflix to help me improve myself in that particular way.
I love it. And it reminds me of that infamous cartoon that comic that you got out there, but with Mario in it, about how, all right, like, can you tell us that story real quick and how that relates to that?
Yeah. So it was a metaphor that just kind of popped in my head one day, and I shared it with someone, and they were like, oh, that's really good. And so I decided to turn it into a visual metaphor, like an image that could be shared. And I've actually never told this story, but this is a User Defenders exclusive. But
yes.
I went like looking to source Mario images, or like the little sprites, so that I could lay out. And for those listening at home, this doesn't have to be like a theater of the mind thing. Basically, the visual metaphor is there's like the tiny, runty, stressed out Mario who's living this very fearful existence where if he touches things, then he dies and it's very stressful. And then he encounters the fire flower and he becomes this giant, bombastic Super Mario who can throw fireballs and it's way more fun. Yes. And so the idea is, you know, the tiny Mario plus the fire flower equals the giant fireball throwing Mario. And the idea being that your business doesn't exist to create fire flowers, it exists to create the fireball throwing Super Marios. Yes. And one is just a means to an end. And that's not the thing, that the flower isn't what gets people excited when they're playing the game. It's the anticipation of being able to throw fireballs.
Yes.
So I had this sort of metaphor. I was like, oh, I should just like draw this out. And so I went looking for images of like, well, you know, what the tiny Mario looks like and the flower and things like that. And I found them, but they weren't very good resolution, and like the colors didn't match up, and it just wasn't really going to work. And I was like, well, these are just pixels, like it's just, you know, squares next to each other with hex colors. Like I could just code this up in CSS. And I thought it was going to take like 20 minutes, and it wound up taking like 3 hours. I have no idea why it took so long, but it took a really long time. And I was like, this is the biggest waste of time. Like, how am I ever going to be able to like account for this evening that I've blown by making this dumb image. And and as you mentioned, that was one of the first things I put out there where it really caught on. And so in retrospect, it was worth it. But I would probably just do it in Photoshop if I were to do it again at this point.
That's awesome. Thanks for telling that story, Samuel. I did not realize that you did that in CSS. That's awesome. Very cool. But I love the whole story of that because it's Michael Hyatt is somebody I listen to, a podcaster and personal growth mentor to me. He says that people only listen to one station. They listen to WIIFM, and that's what's in it for me, right? And I think that's the key to that whole thing. It's like people aren't buying the fire flower. They're buying, like you said, they're buying being able to be a BA throwing these fireballs, right?
Yeah, totally. And I think, you look at just what are some simple human motivations, and it doesn't, you don't have to conclude that people are totally self-absorbed jerks, or people aren't necessarily operating from a place of selfishness, but they have aspirations, and if you can help them get to where they want to go, then that's something that they will very likely exchange their time and or money and or whatever else for.
Love it. Design at the speed of thought with Adobe XD, the first all-in-one UX UI solution for creating beautiful, interactive user experiences for websites and desktop or mobile apps. Adobe XD helps you design, prototype, and even share your experiences with your teammates and stakeholders for feedback. Try the free beta for Mac or Windows today. Go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more. Create, co-design, and collaborate. Building your workflow around a single tool. Real-time board, an endless online whiteboard for enterprise-level visual collaboration. With real-time board, you can collect references, work on user story maps, customer journey maps, create wireframes, and get feedback on designs using this simple visual collaboration platform. Take your UX process to the next level with real-time board. It's there for you every step of the way, from research and ideation to visualization and review. Visit realtimeboard.com/UD to start your free trial and get 25% off your purchase of a paid subscription. Real-time board, whiteboard, finally, in your browser. So I'm going to give you two paths. For the first time, I'm going to give you two paths to this question that I ask my guests. So this question is, do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing? Or what's the weirdest thing you've seen while doing one of your teardowns, your onboarding teardowns?
Yeah. Well, as a general note, anytime I'm getting my haircut or taking a cab ride or anything, one thing I learned a while ago that has paid serious dividends is just to ask, does anything weird ever happen? And then it's always oh man, let me tell you. So if you're ever bored or trying to. Yeah, so this is one of my favorite questions. From the usability testing that I've done, I haven't found... You're always pretty consistently surprised, or you're presented with things that you hadn't considered before, which is kind of the point of usability testing. But I can't think of anything off the top of my head that's been really weird. And then as far as doing the teardowns... Well, okay, I guess I have kind of a weird story. So the way that the teardowns came to be, for people who might not be familiar, the teardowns are a screen by screen slideshow walkthrough with annotation commentary on what the setup process or activation process for different popular web apps are. And that started by, I was doing that as a consultant for companies where I would just go in and find, it wasn't even necessarily onboarding related, but just here's a workflow within your product, and wanting to give them a sense of not just what I would recommend changing, but kind of putting it contextually within the product itself. So I would just make these PDFs that had arrows and labels and, commentary kind of positioned on I would switch the order of these two buttons or whatever that might be. And I was writing the onboarding book at the time and wanted to build up an audience for that to confirm that I could sell it once I was done writing it. And I was like, building an audience, a lot of times, like, you can start a podcast or you can guest blog on other people's blogs or write articles. And I was like, I was just sitting looking at one of the files, the PDF things that I had made for a company that I was working with. And I was like, I bet if I just posted something like this, it might be interesting to people. But then I was like, well, of course, I'm not going to post this one because they paid for it. And that would be a really jerky thing to do, just to like throw it out there without warning them or whatever. But then I was like, wait, there are thousands of other companies who haven't paid me to do this, and I can just do it for free and do whatever I want with it. And so very much at random, I just picked a company that I wasn't familiar with, which turned out to be a company called Less Accounting. And they do they provide accounting work through or help with their software. And I was like, perfect. And I just picked them and I went through it and I created the teardown. And in a similar way to like thinking that I had just totally wasted an evening creating the Super Mario thing, which was also kind of around that time, I created this slideshow and posted it to SlideShare, and SlideShare messed up the aspect ratio. So everything looked really blurry and it just felt like a total waste of a whole workday. And I remember going in that night and being like, well, I just, you know, telling my wife, like, I just blew it again. Like, there's nothing. I just wasted another day. I don't know what I'm doing here. And the next morning I woke up and there was an email from one of the founders of Less Accounting in my inbox. And
oh, no.
I was like, oh, no. Because I was pretty sure they were going to be like, hey, you know, strongly worded name for someone. Saw that you posted this like without our permission. Thanks for like airing our dirty laundry.
Right.
Consider this a cease and desist and you will be hearing from our lawyers. And so I saw the email and like it was in my Gmail. And I just got like the little preview and I didn't know what was in it. And I very trepidatiously clicked on it. Like, oh no, this is going to be bad. And it couldn't have been more of the opposite, where Alan, who was the founder, is the founder, co-founder, wrote and he's like, hey, we saw that you posted this review of our onboarding experience. Thank you so much. We've already made some of the changes that you recommended and have a bunch more planned. It looks like you're writing a book. Can we help promote this on our blog? I was just like, whoa. So yeah, that was like the first like real vote of confidence in that. And like, you know, that has since become kind of my bread and butter. So very, very thankful to Alan. And he did wind up actually endorsing the book on his blog and actually posted the teardown itself on his blog. So much credit to him. But I thought it was going to be one way and it turned out to totally be the other.
Wow, that is such a great story. I love Alan's humility and vulnerability and transparency in doing that. Like that's what a guy, right? To like, hey, yeah, this is where we messed up, and I'm going to share this with you, that somebody took the time to show us, and we're actually doing something about this. So I love that. I love the spirit of that.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, you know, especially at that time, I was just like a total rando from the internet. So, I mean, for him to even, you know, find value in it was one thing, but it does require some, you know, a sense of egolessness to be able to like take anonymous critique from the internet and be like, this is great.
Seriously. Yeah. And I'll tell you too, Samuel, that, I'll tell you how I discovered you is some guy named Luke Rablewski was talking about you. He put you into his talk and promoted you. I don't know if you knew that or not. You and what you were doing with the teardowns was one of his slides at a UX conference I went to. It's Jared's conference, UX Immersion. So yes, and that's how me and probably thousands of others found out about you is through Luke's talk. So
that's crazy. Yeah, I mean, I have looked up to Luke for a very long time. So wow, that's really cool to hear. I had no idea. Awesome. Was it like recently or
this was 3 years ago.
Oh wow, okay.
This was 3 years ago, and yeah, and that's how I found out about you. Was at that talk. It was at UX Immersion Denver. So yeah, there you go. Well, that's an exclusive for you then.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of his talk, so I would have probably keeled over if I had known that if I had suddenly appeared in one of them. So that's really cool to hear.
Yeah, I also learned about Mr. Liney from Luke, too. The hamburger guy, the hoity-toity Mr. Monopoly hamburger menu icon guy.
Right.
So anyway, so that's great. I love that story. This one is about superpowers. I told you I'd get to this. And what's your design superpower, Samuel?
Yeah, I was trying to think of like a snappy answer to that one. And I'm not 100% sure I can deliver in that way. But I care a lot about return on investment and the opposite of which is kind of wasted effort. And so for me, looking at the the biggest picture sense, just human potential with software in our lives and, you know, the thinking of what it is that we can accomplish with all these augmented capabilities is really compelling and, you know, has a lot of gravity in my life. And then in a more specific kind of context, working with different companies or even working myself as a designer to just like, you know, how can I maximize the outcomes of my efforts and how much can I amplify the specific thing that I'm looking to do? And so, I don't know if that's not a one word response for sure.
No, that's cool.
It's a little bit more than just kind of caring or having empathy. It's kind of, you know, having caring, but also caring about the end outcome being something that's actually tangibly improving people's lives and doing so in like a demonstrable kind of way. Yeah. So, I don't know. We could workshop it. I don't know if you have any ideas, but
you know what? Though after I asked you that question, and my mind immediately went, this whole like everything that you've shared so far has demonstrated your design superpowers, Samuel. So it's funny. Like typically, I'll ask that question, and it may just be something that hasn't been really reflected upon yet in the conversation or specifically. But again, right after I asked that question, I'm like, you know what? This whole conversation you've been showing us your design superpowers. So that's, you know, your answer is more than adequate, my friend. And this whole conversation to this point has really revealed a lot of that. So I'd like to say adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
My design kryptonite, I would say, well, one thing that I try to really willfully remind myself is that it's just software. So I just kind of spoke about it in like these high and mighty terms, but you know, it's so easy to get caught up in the kind of Silicon Valley TechCrunch narrative around going out and changing the world and, you know, creating these giant new corporations that have successful IPOs or whatever that might be. And for me, you know, I try to keep things a lot more human scale, which is really like, can we, you know, are there stories that we have where people have said, oh, I was in such a tight bind, but then I used Craigslist and I was able to get a ride back home after my car broke or whatever those kind of things might be. That's a lot more of what I'm focused on from a, I guess you could call it kind of a humanistic perspective. Like,
sure.
It's very easy to tell ourselves stories and get wrapped up in a narrative that maybe does or does not really align with reality or not. And I try to give myself as much of a reality check as possible, as often as possible.
That's great. This is a fun question, Samuel, and it has to do with your superhero name. And I always like to caveat this question because I know that none of us got where we are on our own, and we've surrounded ourselves with great people, and I know you've worked with some great people in your career as well that have helped propel you to where you are, Samuel. But I'd like to ask you, what would your UX superhero name be?
I have no idea. I would say, you know, what I strive to be better at is approaching design from a sense of egolessness, kind of like what we were talking about before. Like at the end of the day, you know, can this stand on its own? Can its value be obvious rather than having to be spun or sold? So as far, again, how to kind of turn that into a word or a phrase, much less a name, but I'm really not sure. But I would say it really stems from caring. So I don't know. something people oriented and caring oriented, most likely.
Caring onboarding man. That needs some work.
I can also say, like, one of the biggest lessons that I've learned just as a human is to focus on how to be helpful to other people. That was something that probably didn't come as naturally to me as I would have liked. But once I picked up on it, another main, you know, hero of mine, someone who's had a really positive effect on my career, is Heaton Shaw. And all of his emails have in the footer is a quote from Zig Ziglar, which is, I should probably know it by word for word at this point, but something along the lines of, you can get anything that you want in life if you focus on helping other people get what they want.
And, I love it. I love that quote, yeah, by the way.
So from my standpoint, like, you know, that being helpful, I think if you can kind of look back on your life and say, whether it was through designing software that has touched people's lives and improved their life situations, or if it's been done in more of a direct kind of way, but ultimately, you know, taking a perspective of servant leadership, or just being of service to people, is something that really, really resonates with me.
I love that. I'm going to take a second to tell a quick story too about that quote, because it's so funny you said that. I just put that in a blog article that I wrote a few days ago. And the reason I wrote this article, it was, there's some similarities with, you were talking about the story about Alan and how you opened your email one day and you're like, oh, what is this? I got an email recently from Eric Meyer, who was a co-founder of the Event of Parts with Jeffrey Zeldman. I got an email from him, and the subject line was AEA Denver and User Defenders. And I thought, oh, this is an email that's geo-targeted. He knows I'm in Denver, and he's just letting me know about the event coming, the very first one in Denver. And I opened it. That was kind of the fixed mindset of me reading that into that line. And then I opened the email, and I said, hey, Jason, how would you like to record a live episode at the very first ever AEA Denver at the end of the year? And I was like, yeah. And it was just one of those things. I was just like, man, I can't believe this. So anyway, I wrote a post about it, and I just said, you know, and I think it just has to do with being able to host this show, being able to know that this content is helping designers. There's a lot of aspiring designers that listen to this and are really getting a lot out of this by having wonderful guests like you, Samuel, and others that I've been able to have. You mentioned Aaron Walter. I was able to have him on. But anyway, not to pontificate too much, but I just felt like I wanted to share that story, because I felt like that was just one of those moments where I was like, wow, you know what? You can get what you want when you really help others get what they want. So I thank you for sharing that quote and that story, Samuel.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that story reminds me, when I was writing the book, I reached out to, like, I literally just made a list with pen and paper of all of the designers who had really inspired me throughout, you know, my career up until that point. And was like, oh my, you know, it'd be amazing if I could interview Ryan Singer from Basecamp, or it'd be amazing if I could interview Steven Anderson, or all these different people. Yeah. And I reached out to them, and I was shocked at the amount of people who responded. I mean, it was almost like 100% of people like, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do it. Let's make it happen. And I think part of that is the design community being really just naturally giving and open in that way.
Yes.
But I think it's also because, like, you know, at this point in my career, I get a fair amount of emails that are like, clearly they're emailing, like you said, it's a form thing. Like, I'm writing an article on this, and I'm looking for, like, you know, buzzword filled sentences from people, and I don't even really know who you are, but I'm pretending to. and to just write an email instead that's like, hey, I remember 10 years ago when you gave this talk, and this has totally influenced my work. Wow. And, you know, has crept up in X, Y, and Z. And just to let people know that, like, they connected with you in a really meaningful way, I think can be surprisingly effective, but also kind of like to what we're both saying, like, you actually have to be genuine and care in order for that to work.
Mm. Yes, that is so true. Well, Samuel, let's wrap up the show with the imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
Being helpful, I think, if you can kind of look back on your life and say, whether it was through designing software that has touched people's lives and improved their life situations, or if it's been done in more of a direct kind of way, but ultimately, you know, taking a perspective of servant leadership, or just being of service to people, is something that really, really resonates with me.
I love that.
As a person, just like my orientation in the world is I'm always really, really excited to learn. And so for me, what has really influenced my design career has not only been learning everything that I can that's kind of nominally within the range of design, but also looking into all kinds of other more established fields like psychology, behavioral economics, architecture, urban planning, landscape design, video game design for sure has a lot of overlaps with the world of software. Mm-hmm. And I found that you can kind of just go out and find a lot of truffles or a lot of gems in neighboring fields or institutions, and then, you know, apply them in a fairly one-to-one kind of capacity to what you, you know, are working on within your product itself. So if I were to give anyone a single recommendation, that would at least be one of them, is to just be curious about the world and find ways to make use of the commonalities between different things in your life with, you know, and import that into your product design perspective.
I love it. Stay curious, defenders, and always, always keep your audience in mind, the people you're designing for. That's awesome. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
A UX resource or tool that I can recommend, I would say,
First of all, I would say useronboard.com.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say that one.
But, I'll say that.
I'm biased, but I do recommend it. I would say where I have honestly probably gotten at least an outsized source of inspiration for me has been a web series called Extra Credits, which is on YouTube, and it's an animated, usually they're like 5 to 7 minute long videos that are kind of like mini lectures on different aspects of video game design. So sometimes it might be about, you know, how to take your video game to market, but the ones that I find to be the richest and most rewarding are when they break down something like how to design an effective tutorial in your game, or how to design the first 5 minutes of your game, or how to think about player agency when you're creating levels, or different things along those lines. And so that's something that I really, really strongly recommend. And mostly because I've just myself gotten so much out of it.
Awesome. I'll be sure to link to that in the show notes as well. It sounds like it would definitely be helpful for our defenders and myself. I'd like to see it as well.
Yeah, I find myself constantly wanting to share them. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Hi, I'm Rachel Andrew, and you're listening to the User Defenders podcast with Jason Ogle.
So I got one more question for you, but I lied. I have two. There's one that's nagging at me, and it's something I made a note of. It's not one of my normal questions, but it has to do. I'm gonna ask you this one first, and then before I ask you that last one, this one has to do with your wonderful article. I think it's your most recent one. It's called Product People Mind the Gap. And great article, Samuel. Thank you for writing it. It's incredible. I'm going to link to it. Defenders, read it. You have a lot of really great insight as into building products and some of the most forgotten elements for product designers when they're actually building the thing. And you use the idea of break it down to determine what happens in between where they are when they're using the product and where they want to be after using it. And I love that. It's some great ideas. As I was reading this article, Samuel, something struck me about that concept. And it's something I have a tug of war with, and I venture that maybe some of our listeners may also have some struggles like this, because the sentiment behind the article, which I totally agree with, is fill in the gaps, right? Think about the details and design for those possibilities. Don't leave your user hanging on the other side of the cliff, right? Like build a bridge for them, which makes perfect sense. But my question is, how much help is too much to where the product gains needless complexity? Right. What's the balance? How do we strike that balance? Right. To where we're like building the bridge, but we're not spelling every single thing out. right? To where all of a sudden we have this, it's certainly not an MVP, right? It's like one of those screens that you put on your article where it's like, we designed this product, but it's so dang confusing that we need an overlay screen with like 100 annotations on it. Does that make sense? Right. My question? How do totally, we balance that out?
Yeah. So, I probably have a few answers to that question. Okay. I will see if I can get them all squished into one. I would say, speaking of like inspirational quotes, there's another one that I think of and try to keep present in my mind kind of all the time when I'm designing. John Wooden from the world's most successful college basketball coach from UCLA back in the day.
Legend.
Had a saying, which is never mistake activity for accomplishment. And I think that it's entirely possible to give people a ton of busy work and a ton of hoops to jump through. And again, like tying it back to user onboarding, a lot of times when I see people invest in user onboarding, it's giving people a tooltip tour that they have to click next 20 times on, or dragging them by the ear through different features. And then once they have like gone through the motions of like clicking three different places in your product, then like they're quote unquote onboarded and your work is done. Or of course that isn't the case, where there's this real world, so to speak, motivation where someone has, you know, is aspiring to be better at something, and the onboarding isn't really done until they are better at that thing, regardless of how complex your product is, or even especially it kind of in defiance to how complex your product is. So whenever possible, I like to identify, you know, in a software agnostic kind of sense, what is the real world situation that someone's trying to get out of, and what is the real world situation that they're trying to get into, and how can we afford that? How can we create affordances for that where they can make that transition as easily and painlessly and ideally as enjoyably as possible without giving them a bunch of busy work in between? Ideally, you know, you're taking the work off of their plate rather than putting work onto their plate. So that's one answer. But specifically, like how you kind of make those decisions within your product from a feature by feature or screen by screen or label by label or instruction by instruction kind of basis. I don't know if I really have a rule of thumb other than to put it in people's hands and see what they do with it and see how they respond to it. And if they're responding in the quote unquote wrong way, then probably getting rid of things is going to help more than adding things will, or at least reducing things down to a simpler and more digestible sort of form rather than, I don't usually talk this much about Basecamp, but Jason Fried from Jason Fried from Basecamp, who's another person that I've really looked up to, created this Flickr group years ago called Signs on Signs, where they would he would find these examples in the wild where like there might be a sign at a library that says please be quiet, and then there's another sign attached to that sign pointing to it saying please look at the sign, or you know, in a parking garage or something like that, and he's like, the job of a sign is to be noticed. Like, if you have to create another sign to drive awareness to the sign you made, maybe there's just something wrong with the original sign. And anytime I encounter little like hotspots or tooltips or whatever it might be in a product, I always think like, what's the version of this that isn't a sign on a sign? If people are missing really crucial steps in your product, or if people are getting confused or distracted at different points, maybe don't add a sign on top of it that redirects their attention. Just create something that intuitively guides their intention from the beginning. So I mean, I definitely agree with you. Like, it's not something where you're just trying to create a lot of tedious steps that are kind of patronizing to the end user. It's more about how can you remove those boundaries as much as possible to more effortlessly get them from where they currently are to where they want to be.
Very nice. Very nice. And I, you know, it harkens me. That sounds very dated, but it harkens unto me, dear saint, that, that this is the era of writing. it reminds me, and a lot of, I think a lot of the teardowns, the ones that you've done that I've really enjoyed the most are the ones where the designers and those behind the product have a lot of fun. They have a lot of fun with the process, right? And they throw their personality into it, right? And I think that goes back to writing and knowing your audience too, but also just being clever and being clever to a point where you're not being a jerk, right? Because there's a fine line there, but where people just put their personality into that whole process. Those have been some of my most enjoyable ones. And of course, your awesome 80s sense of humor and the fun stuff you throw into your teardowns too make it fun for me too. But it's really, you're playing off of what somebody's already doing in that process. But I keep reading about this, and I really feel like it's true that great UX, and from now on, and even from, like, you know, 5 years ago from now on, has been about writing too. And it's sort of that invisible kind of character in the story. But I think that it is really more than ever, and especially in the future, good writing is going to be a huge part of a great user experience. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely would. I would say, you know, I mean, writing, you could make an argument that if you define writing loosely enough, like, that is kind of what makes humans humans, as far as having the collective intelligence. And, you know, what separates us from apes is the fact that, like, we could go from how to make fire to building rocket ships in not that many generations. It's right. Because of, you know, taking the what one person can learn in a lifetime and expanding that out to as many other people as that learning can reach, and building off of that learning. And I mean, so from that standpoint of just having, like, you know, communication, I would very much agree with that. And I would even take it a step further to think about your product. Think about interacting with software. Approach it like you would approach a conversation, where because in a lot of ways, and like, I know that like chat bots are, like, all the rage these days, and I don't know if I totally a lot of smart people are really excited about it, and I guess the best way I can say is, like, I don't really see where they're coming from, but I'm open to learning. But because, like, well, I don't want to get off on a rant, but, like, it's like, you know, phone trees, where it's like, to talk to marketing, press 1, to do this other thing, press 2. Like, nobody likes those, but all of a sudden, if it's in text form, then, like, yeah. But anyway, the point being, whether you're explicitly having a conversation, like in a chat sort of scenario, or if you're just operating software by clicking buttons and getting responses and then clicking more buttons and getting more responses to those, it is a lot like the way you navigate a conversation. And so I think it's really, really healthy to approach product design as if you were investing in a conversation that hasn't happened yet, where your side of it is pre-recorded. And think about how your product responds to what someone does. Think about how your product can guide people into intuitively finding, you know, intuitively doing the right thing rather than having to stop and think about it. All these different ways. And so whether that is verbally written to them with, you know, micro copy or lines of instruction, or inline validation that says that your email doesn't look like it's quite right before you submit the whole form, I think that's great. Any kind of, you know, just in time or pithy copy that guides people in the right direction, I think is a wonderful thing. The only thing I would push back on is that another one of my favorite sayings is that only one part of the brain speaks English. And so there are a lot of behavioral cues and prompts that you have at your disposal to communicate urgency, or that a decision needs to be made, or that a subtle change in behavior needs to take place, or whatever that might be within a product. You aren't relegated to just explicitly telling people to do something. Ideally, if your product didn't even have any words in it, it would still generally guide people into the direction that they needed to go. So, which, just to be totally clear, I'm not saying, like, replace all your menus with icons or whatever. I'm just saying that there are ways to give those similar kind of prompts. And I would also call that writing, if you want to be liberal enough with the term.
Yes. So good. I love the idea too of approaching your interface like a conversation. You know, Aaron Gustafson wrote about that too in his great book, Adaptive Web Design, about, you know, making accessible experiences for everyone. And it's like, it is, it really is a conversation. When somebody's interacting with your product, they really are in many ways having a conversation with you. And because we're part of our products that we create, and, you know, going back to the writing, we're putting our personalities into it and everything like that. So yeah, let's have good conversations with our products. I love that what you just added there, Samuel. Some great value in that answer. And this is my last question, I promise. And it's one of my favorites because I really have a heart for the folks listening. I call them defenders fondly because they do want to fight for the users and they want to fight for their businesses and to do their best work. So I want to ask you, what's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes?
I would say, just from like a career advice standpoint, I'm asked that question every so often, and I'm always kind of surprised because it usually involves something like, I really want to get into UX, but my job isn't giving me opportunities to do that. Or, you know, I would like to transition my career over, but I just don't have the experience, or things like that. And one thing that I would really like to impart as much as possible is, like, I didn't either. And it's just something that I always found, even when I had bosses that were or employers or managers or whatever you might want to call that, who like were really great people and really effective at what they did, like they were never going to be as invested in my career advancement as I was. And picking up on that early on, I think, saved me a lot of time, because I was like, oh, well, if I don't have any experience conducting usability tests, I can just do that. I could just find a company. I don't even have to charge them for it. It's not even like I need to figure out how to sell it. Like, I can just do that, and then I can say that I have done that. So as far as just kind of taking, I guess, what you might call more of a DIY sort of approach, like, really at the end of the day, like, look at what the barrier is preventing you from getting situationally, getting from where you are to where you want to be, and you know, taking matters into your own hands. I think it's a lot easier than people might believe, and maybe even than our industry would lead people to believe. There's a lot of mysticism around different UX methodologies or dogmas or things like that, and I think that you don't really need to like have learned all of the ins and outs of a contextual inquiry or persona design or whatever, if what you really just care about is like, can I make this thing better for humans? So there's a lot of opportunity to do that in a fairly freestyle / DIY kind of capacity. And I've been really happy that I've taken those opportunities into my own hands when I have. And I think pretty much anyone else could do that if that's something that they have an inclination for.
Awesome. So good. Always be learning, defenders. ABL. Always be learning. You own that, right? No one else can own that but you. So great advice from Samuel. Samuel, as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
If you would like to stay on top of what I'm doing, everything professionally goes through useronboard.com, because useronboarding.com was taken when I was registering it. So I got useronboard.com.
Hey, less characters.
Yeah, exactly. It's easier to type. Also on Twitter, same thing, useronboard. And also on Twitter is my personal one, which is Samuel Hulick. So anywhere between those three.
Oh, awesome, Samuel. Man, I got to tell you, this has been so enriching for me, and I know our defenders listening to are going to take away so much from this conversation, and I appreciate you so much being here and doing this, staying up late later to do this. This probably isn't late for you, right? This is probably early for you. This is late for me, but I appreciate you doing this, and I cannot wait to share this, Samuel. It's been a great pleasure. I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Likewise.
How about those value bombs dropped by Samuel? I loved his insights about balancing features in products and filling in the gaps, especially when designing onboarding experiences for our users. We spend so much time building quality products, let's not phone it in when designing the process meant to recruit those users to something that could actually add value to their lives. Let's fulfill their hope that our products will give them the superpowers they envisioned they'd have when they first took a chance on our product. Thanks so much for listening and taking me and my super guest with you to the gym, on your commute to work, during your workout or work day. I'm super grateful at the opportunity to serve you and would love to hear from you anytime. Hit me up on the Twitters at UserDefenders. I want to thank Chris Combs for the extraordinary editing, Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork, and Darren Goldsmith for the sensational show notes. In two weeks, be sure to tune into my lost interview with UX and web design veteran, Nick Fink. And until next time, fight on, my friends.